Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix. I'm Johnny Anonymous.
And I'm Dave Rabbit.
And I'm John Rhodes.
John Rhodes?
The hell's he doing on the show?
What are you doing here, John?
I have connections, man.
Man.
I have connections. And I'm
Black helicopter guys?
Those kind of guys and more.
All right, very good. We haven't seen you around the forum lately, John. What's going on?
Oh, I'm sorry about that, guys. I've been really, really busy. And that's one of the reasons I'm going to be planning on going dark in my forum for a while. I've just got too many commitments in the area of the media that I've got challenges ahead of me that are going to demand that kind of time that I would otherwise have into late night hours to spend online chatting with you guys and also with the different members out there.
It's not a matter that you don't love us anymore.
Oh, no. I love you in that manly way.
Yeah, right. That's not what you said at the gay bar 3 weeks ago, John.
It's what they say on hunting trips up in Montana.
Yeah, yeah. You like Gladiator movies, John?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Nothing.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what's going on here. I went to the History Channel website just the other day, and I could have swore I saw you in a video on Monster Quest.
Yeah, that might be correct. I'm appearing on 3 of their clips out there and planning to do more with them, doing some roaming reporter-type things, and also other challenging projects on the plate right now. That's one of the reasons I just don't have the time anymore to be online. So you are correct.
Well, you know, I tell you, John, I mean, you know, we've been friends since almost a year ago from the Bay Area UFO Expo in San Jose. You know, I when you first told me that, you were going to have to not do the Conspiracy Master thing anymore simply because you were involved in new projects. But, you know, the first thing I thought of, John, is I am so proud of you, brother. I am so, so proud of you, and congratulations, endless congratulations, because I know you went through a period of time, you know, where you were really, you had some aspirations of what you wanted to do. But, man, this is a great deal you've come into, man.
It's just one of, like, several projects I've got in the works. I'm also got some openings for doing projects out in towards the Hollywood area. So everything that I'm involved with is pretty much bringing the fruit of all my research into the public view by presenting on television or through film. So no matter what projects I'm involved in, not only are they creative, they have elements of the research truth that's been discovered in them. And this is the way Hollywood operates, you know. They either are reading internet sites like yours and garnering information from members of yours that have been placing it on site and then working it into creative projects. This way, a lot of the truth gets out without any kind of fear-provoking announcements.
Right.
So that's just my part of it.
Well, kudos to you, my friend. And speaking of research, you know, the last time we had you on a couple of months ago, you were talking about some diseases and cattle mutilations that were going on. And I believe, what was it, in Montana?
Well, yeah, this is just one branch of the many mutilations that happened across the world. But I was showing you how there are connections with the wind directions and pinpointing where different types of MRSA, which is this staphylococcal infectious diseases that aren't responsive to antibiotics, are coming from, and that it might be animal food feeding operations might be affecting the food chain by introducing different types of parasites to us through the food chain. It's not a good idea, and that just might be what the Montana cattle mutilations are. Somebody's actually taking samples and then tracking the progression of the environmental effects of these different types of diseases.
With you being involved now with the TV shows and all the other little projects you have going on, are you still going to be keeping up with your research?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to move to the southern entrance of the Yosemite National Park in the area of Mariposa, California. Not only did I back about 4 or 5 years ago have a sighting, a very close sighting of a triangular craft over the area. But there have also been sightings of reptilian humanoids in the area, and Bigfoot sightings have occurred there historically. So the region is really rich with mystery and also black government operations that are occurring in that region. And it looks to me like to be not only something that is going to be fruitful as far as getting, you know, new information out of there, but also maybe being able to get some evidence of different types out there as well.
Well, you know, John, you still, and it, although there's some shows that are really getting close, but right now, I just went to the website just to kind of look at it again, and show 22, which we did with you, which was about reptoids, has 11,168 views. Now, that's obviously mostly guest or whatever, because the people that subscribe to the feeds, they don't reflect in those numbers, but you hold still the number one ATS mix show as far as garnering interest about a topic since ATS mix started over a year ago. Congrats.
Wow, thank you very much. Well, you know, the subject itself is really compelling and really fascinating and intriguing. The difficulty is just being able to ignore all the wild hearsay that's out there and all the video internet things where they say, look at, oh, he must be a reptoid because his eyes are turning vertical. If anybody would just use some common sense when looking at the subject matter and just disregard those types of statements and those types of observations, not right. That all of them need to be disregarded, but the majority of them do because they're just artifacts, video artifacts, and I'm very well versed with this, there actually is something lingering inside that phenomenon that has a sense of reality to it, because I think on the very deepest level of human consciousness, we know that there's something real going on, but we just can't put our fingers on it. So it not only makes it thought-provoking, but also it can stimulate a lot of fear and wonder in people.
Right. Well, we wish you all the best, my friend, and of course you will keep coming back here and join us on the show, right?
I will, if not for anything more, to hear about Dave's dinners.
Yeah, they didn't hear that. They didn't hear that story, so they're going to go, what do they mean about Dave's
dinners? Yeah, the audience, audience members, they cut that out, and I think it was for a good reason.
That's right.
I don't know if it was for a good reason, but it's for a timing reason.
For a timing reason. Yes, that's absolutely right.
Well, John, I appreciate you coming on with the intro with us.
It's always good, Dave, Johnny. I look forward to doing many more shows with you guys.
Well, you know we love you, brother.
Okay, and hey, Dave, we got to do one about Vietnam someday.
We definitely are going to do that. I promise you.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Thank you so much, you guys.
And what we have coming up on this show, of course, is we've got our UFO sightings.
And we have the second part of the Colm Kelleher interview, as well as another Skeptic Unleashed.
That's right. He is unleashed. And so why wait any longer? Let's get right to it.
All righty.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From above topsecret.com.
Ah, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
These are the reported sightings over the United States. This is David C. In Ohio, numerous viewers observed two big amber or orange globe-like lights moving slowly across the sky toward the southeast. They were large, dime-sized globes, amber or orange in color, about 1,000 feet apart and low in the sky. They were making no sound and moving very slowly. The round and globe-like objects were stationary and then moved slowly to the north and then suddenly changed color to a glowing white and zoomed off at an intense speed and out of sight. In Colorado, an orange oval-shaped light was observed moving in a downward angle. It stopped and just sat there. It faded out for a moment and then came back in the same location. A second light, identical to the first, swooped in from the right-hand side very quickly and stopped instantly, directly next to the first light in a vertical line. Directly following, a third light appeared, coming in the same manner as the second, same approach pattern, same direction, same speed. It stopped suddenly next to the other two lights, and the three lights formed a vertical line. After about a minute of them sitting in a line, the first light moved in a circular pattern over the second light, and the third light moved in between the two lights. It was like the first and third light were chasing each other, or playing tag as the second light sat motionless. Then the first and third light moved off in the direction the lights had originally come from. One of the viewers stated, "The objects moved very quickly in tight patterns and stopped instantly. I can tell you that it wasn't fireworks because they can't stay in the air and form perfect vertical lines. I can tell you it wasn't a spotlight of any kind because the lights were orange in color and very bright, unlike a spotlight, which just reflects off of a cloud cover and can only be seen brightly on a cloudy night." This is David C., reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe with sightings from across Canada. In mid-June, a resident of Vancouver, BC, was out walking the dog at 11 p.m. and felt compelled to look up to spy a fairly large blue ball directly overhead. As it traveled quietly across the sky from south to north, it left a trail of green and yellow light in its wake. It moved consistently and its appearance didn't alter for the 5 to 8 seconds it was observed. Moving to Corunna, Ontario, for a multiple sighting report, a husband and wife have been disturbed for at least 2 years now by the weekly appearances of white objects zigzagging across the sky. Too low to be satellites and too high to be planes, these bright white objects erratically traverse the night sky, flying slowly, then fast, changing direction, then zipping upward and disappearing. One such evening in the fall of 2007, the couple walked out onto their driveway to view a glowing object flying from right to left of their field of vision. The witness reporting then suggested they beckon the object to come to them. No sooner was the invitation issued than the object turned and headed towards them. They ducked to the back stoop out of sheer terror and the object shot up and away out of sight. In May of this year, while seeing some friends out, they all spotted an object in daylight hours and determined it was a wingless, shiny, oval, soundless object with, quote, a sort of head to it, unquote. It too accelerated and shot out of view in seconds. The witness speculated that the proximity of refineries and industrial plants, which occasionally set off flares from the stacks, may be attracting these objects this frequently. This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe, keeping my eyes to the skies for AboveTopSecret.com.
Now, from the AboveTopSecret.com mobile headquarters team, currently begging for gas money outside a Quickie Mart in Wichita, Kansas, it's the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous.
Well, John, I happen to notice that our mystery guest light is blinking again.
Yes, it certainly is, Senor Rabbit. You know what that means? That means we got somebody waiting to teleport over onto the ATS Mix soapbox.
Well, we didn't burn up anybody in our last teleportation effort, so why don't you teleport our guest on over, John?
All right, buddy. Here's your goggles. Make sure you have them on securely.
Got them and all secured.
Right. Now, remember, as I told you last time, things are going to get a little bit queasy as we're going to be bending time and space, so are you ready?
Sure, John. I'm ready. I was born ready. Hit the switch, Johninator.
All right there, Senor Rabbit. Engaging the teleportation in 3, 2, 1.
From the soapbox, it's, excuse me. Could you maybe introduce yourself, please?
My name is Ruben Uriarte. I'm the state director for Northern California MUFON. How many of you have ever thought of being a MUFON or just a UFO investigator? Well, here's your chance. If you join MUFON, you may be able to attend some of the greatest workshops that we're going to be having. On Thursday, July 24th, we're going to be having workshops such as field investigations, how to conduct radiation site surveys, abduction investigations, that's going to be led by the famous Bud Hopkins, photo video analysis, physical evidence collection, scientific data, and dealing with the media and so forth. Please join MUFON and you'll have a chance to attend these workshops. If not, we'll still invite you anyway. On Friday, we're going to be having some international experts. The United States is not alone when it comes to UFO sightings and evidence. Military, government officials, pilots, and aviation specialists from around the globe are now coming forward with results of investigations documenting military and aviation encounters with UFOs. Some of our guests that will be coming will be General Wilfred de Brouwer from Belgium, Jeronimo Flores and Victor Camacho from Mexico, Dr. Anthony Choi from Peru, Dr. Richard Haynes from NASA, Leslie Keene, an investigative reporter with the Coalition of Freedom of Information, George Knapp, 14-time Emmy Award-winning journalist, will be talking about what's been occurring at the Skinwalker Ranch. Don Ledger, he's an author and pilot, will be talking about UFO encounters with pilots in Canada. We have an aerospace engineer by the name of Larry Lemke, who will be talking about the O'Hare case and his involvement of the study of the object that actually punched a hole in the cloud right above Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. Then we have Mr. Nick Pope, who was with the Ministry of Defense from the UK, and he'll be talking about the recent developments in the United Kingdom and the release of the files from the Ministry of Defense. Also, we'll have Ted Rowe, who's also with NARCAP, National Aviation Reporting Center, on anomalous phenomena. He'll be talking more on aviation safety and how pilots report their cases, or the underreporting of pilots, from pilots, about their reluctance because of the implications involved when a pilot reports a UFO, how that might impact their career. Then we have Farah Yalusu, who will be talking about Turkey's latest UFO investigations. Ken Cherry, State Director of MUFON from Texas, will be talking about some of the latest cases that had occurred, and plus what had happened in Stevensville, Texas, and how the MUFON was involved in investigating and interviewing the many witnesses down there. For those who want to attend this great event coming up, they can definitely contact our MUFON office, which our toll-free number is 1-888-817-2000, or you can look up the information on our website, which is www.mufon.com. The event is going to be held at the fabulous DoubleTree Hotel, located at 2050 Gateway Place in San Jose, California, right next door to the San Jose International Airport. Thank you.
Being part of the revolution is easy. Star, flag, and dig the mother. Whether you find a great topic or really enjoy one of our podcasts, you can make it even better by taking the time to show your appreciation and applause by giving the material a star, then flag, and finally a dig. This will draw attention to the thread or podcast, and by doing so, you're making a difference and improving the ATS, BTS, and Above Politics experience. So remember, when you find a great thread or podcast, star, flag, and dig the mother. Thanks for being part of the revolution from your friends at the Above Networks, LLC.
And now it's time for a different view. This is the Skeptic Overview.
It is time once again for the Skeptic Overview, and that means that we bring on the guy in tights, known as the Skeptic Overlord, to come join the two guys known as the ATS Mix Team. So that's one amigo, two ATS Mix Team members, and a
partridge in a pear tree. That was very interesting, John. I really like that. Yeah, right.
I do better when I'm awake.
Really? Well, boss, how are you doing?
Terrible.
Are you really? What's going on?
What's up?
Well, what you can imagine what happens when you put off the one thing that's easy to put off that you shouldn't put off, going to the dentist.
Brushing your teeth. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Well, it's, you know, and it wasn't terrible, but I had a couple cavities that needed attention, and he warned me. When I was in the chair this morning, they said, "You know, later today when the Novocaine wears off, these are gonna smart."
Really? Mm-hmm.
And he was right.
And we don't mean smart in a good way, right?
That's right. So since about for the past 3 hours, I've been self-medicating with bourbon. So
I loved it when you self-medicate with bourbon. We have great shows.
New,
when you self-medicate,
right?
You know.
I can definitely relate to the dentist thing. About a month ago, I set up an appointment with my dentist. Then I had to go to do the Monterey gig up there with a Project Firefly, and so I had to postpone it. And I go, "When can you reschedule me?" And they said, "The 22nd of July." And I go, "What?" So I'm suffering with a back molar in the same condition, which it's in great pain and tempting to just take aspirin for it.
Well, I'm happy to say my bottom lip is now working, so we'll be able to go on the podcast.
But you know, I really like it when it goes numb. You know what I'm saying? And you can't feel anything, and you know, bite your lip and bite your inside of your lip. I especially enjoy that one.
I figured you'd like that.
Yeah, it reminds me of the old Taiwanese torture chamber and stuff.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, what I want to do is quickly run down just the headlines of the topics that got a lot of activity this week, And then touch on one that didn't get a lot of action, but sort of probably because the topic isn't fully fleshed out, and more will be coming out in about 3 or 4 weeks. And it could provide the framework for the grand conspiracy of all time. So it'll be interesting to watch this topic develop. Anyway, just quickly running down, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time today. The violent encounter with an alien being posted by Dan Tanna, the notorious thread, has 1,150 replies this evening. That was started on July 6th. It's worth a look, but it's one of those threads that just has gone nuts. So we'll see how this one develops. Another thread, the second most popular, 358 replies about overthrowing the United States government. Posted by O22A6AR. I imagine those are his top secret call letters or something.
Is he an honorary Muslim?
I don't. Why?
I don't know. You know, the topic, the whole thread subject matter.
Oh, no. It's more, the subject matter is more from an internal standpoint of sort of along the same lines that we were talking about the guns is, you know, the whole point of the militia was to be there in case we needed to overthrow the government.
Right.
And that's the point of view that he's coming from.
How do you become an honorary Muslim, John?
It's either on or off, isn't it?
I thought so. You know, I didn't
have to. Did I not mention before that I was quite tired?
Does that make you a Muslim?
No, but it definitely makes my bits not quite as good as they usually are.
Sorry.
So is everybody else.
I didn't mean to throw us off of the deep end of the ocean.
Everybody, sorry about Johnny.
We'll just keep knocking those balls together all night.
Oh, hey.
Whoa. Well, stay away from mine.
That's right up Dave's alley.
So the next most popular, if you live in California, you will die tomorrow. Save yourself. Since this was posted yesterday morning and everyone in California is still alive.
Congratulations. I think
we're okay. You made it through another catastrophe.
Yeah, we talked to a guy today that he's alive, and John is alive, so I guess that's all right.
Yes, so we're in good shape.
Good.
The real Iran, what many people don't know, posted by Orange Alarm Clock on July 1st. Almost 300 replies. Very interesting thread about some of the real stuff that's going down in the country of Iran.
Right.
And going on, it's how are you coping these days? Share your story. It's pretty much about the about how the manure is essentially hitting the fan on so many different fronts, and a lot of interesting member stories about how they're dealing with the high price of gas and the high price of food, and the mortgage craziness and everything else going on. And those are really the top topics that are getting replies this week. There's a few others, but. What I want to do, is, because we're pressed for time, is get into the topic that was launched on ATS in the news forum by member Dimensional Detective on July 5th. And it's a really interesting topic linking to a New York Times article titled Tablet Ignites Debate on Messiah and Resurrection. And the real quick description is this: there's been a stone tablet in existence for some time that's passed around between, I think, two or three antiquities collectors. And the most recent person who has this tablet has sort of realized, wait a minute, this thing looks like it might actually be pretty important. It was traced back to having been recovered in the same area where the Dead Sea Scrolls were recovered. And the words on this tablet are not carved into it. They're written with ink. And as it turns out, that was a rather common record-keeping or journal method of some of the Jewish scholars of the era. And this thing dates to having been created sometime in the century before Christ. So it's sometime between 100 and 0 B.C., and the interesting thing about this, as these scholars look at it, and that dating has been corroborated, I think, through three different sources now, by the way, both in the ink and the stone and a few other things, and just the scholarliness, you know, the language being used in the writing. And the scholar who's been analyzing this pretty much the most at this point is by the name of Professor Knoll, K-N-O-H-L, who's been looking at this, and he's been published a book back in 2000 where he put forth the idea that the suffering Messiah and rising from the dead 3 days after persecution was a common motif in early Judaism around the era of Christ, and is a motif that could have predated Christ. And he based that theory on some rabbinic literature and apocalyptic literature, and also what he was able to pull out of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But really, it wasn't anything decisive until he saw this tablet that is now called Gabriel's Revelation, that actually describes a guy named Simon, who was described as a Messiah, who suffered for the purpose of Israel's salvation. Killed by a Roman captain, it looks like, and then rose from the dead 3 days later to save Israel. And this raises lots of questions, according to the scholars, that the story of Christ and what Christ said was going to happen to him, how he was going to rise from the dead 3 days later, appears to be actually a common Messiah motif of the Jews of that day. And it is, for lack of a better description, it is creating a manure storm in the theological circles as people try to piece together what this actually means. Because this group that Simon and his followers were essentially insurgents, Jewish insurgents trying to fight against the Romans of their day.
Wow.
And so the reaction of this, and also now if you extend that forward to some of the craziness that was in that Da Vinci Code movie on how there were questions at the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
And if you actually do follow, and even before the Da Vinci Code movie came out, you know, a lot of people who are into the conspiracy side of things were generally aware that the most important thing to come out of the Council of Nicaea was to determine who Jesus was and what importance he really had in Christianity.
Right.
And there was a lot of material that they discarded, that they threw out, that they even destroyed, that didn't hold up with their the Nicene Creed that resulted from the council. So this tablet, what it presents and what it means, and some of the other things as you read through the actual article, some of the other revelations on this tablet, it starts to paint the picture that, you know, that maybe the Jesus story was just another attempt to scare the Romans, or just another group of freedom fighters or something, and it just blew up from there as they kept trying to throw off the rule of the Romans back in that time.
Hmm. John, I'm going to let you go first because...
The next step with this tablet is there are some... that's just the sort of the news about it being revealed. And in about 3 to 4 weeks, we're going to start to see some more detailed analysis of it come out in more of a peer-reviewed paper and another book as well.
John?
So, I am on bated breath as as to what they will find.
Well, that's scary.
With it, well, as Bill said, as the weeks continue, probably more information will be released on this. I think it's been, I don't know, about 60 years or so since any of the Dead Sea Scrolls have turned up. So this is kind of interesting because, if I recall correctly, didn't this happen? Wasn't this tablet found about 100 years ago before it ended up in the Swiss collector's collection?
Oh, I didn't. I thought it was more recent. I think the actual tablet was discovered quite some time ago. However, only recently was it realized that this was something important. And it was actually uncovered in the same general vicinity as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the tablet is thought to be, you know, one of likely several tablets recording the goings on of a Jewish sect of that time.
Well, depending on what more they find from it, I could see that this could be definitely a big challenge to a lot of people's theological faith if they profess of the Judeo-Christian faith. I could see a lot of people scratching their heads on this. Here again, depending on what they're able to find, from what I recall, I think that the tablet that they found, besides it being broken in one area, a lot of the text is faded away. So there's a lot of conjecture as to what actually was there, you know, before it faded away. So I'm very, very interested. I'm piqued with interest. But I'm
yeah. As you look through this, some of the other articles on this are saying that the scholars that are looking at this and comparing it with the Dead Sea Scrolls are finding that some of the phraseology and the way the words are used and spelled in this tablet are starting to shed new light on what they're seeing in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. Like, it's, you know, whenever you're trying to piece together an old language, the more source material you can get, the better off you are. And apparently there's some critical source material that's helping that and is shedding new light on passages in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well.
Yeah, and I'm not opposed to new information. That is probably one of the reasons why I'm no longer a minister. But the whole concept here behind what I just said is because at one time, we pretty much as a mankind used to think that the world was flat. It wasn't until new information came out that, hey, you can take another step beyond. Yes, you can sail another mile on the ocean and not fall off. So I'm not opposed to new information coming out, and I think it behooves us to keep our minds open to any new information. The one passage, even when I was a kid, that I remember the ministers on both sides of the family, both mom and pop side, that they drove into me, deeply inculcated, was this: search for me as you would find gold. And that was a scripture that stayed with me for a long time. So I think that you have to keep all possibilities open and continue. So if you are going to be following some type of Judeo-Christian faith, that you have to continually be searching for that. And that also, just as a sidebar, also probably was my downfall into getting me interested into searching for gold in actuality.
Right. There you go.
John, do you still have your minister collar?
No. Well, no.
Well,
I was going to go somewhere else, and then I thought, better not.
Yeah, I was going to go somewhere else, too.
Because Dave Rabbit would have taken me on a Mel Brooks Blazing Saddles road or something, you know.
I've decided I'm not going to go that path.
Did you eat some bush beans?
It becomes a mainstay. Okay. First off, I got to say, Dimensional Detective has become one of my very favorite posters on the AboveTopSecret.com. It seems like everything that this guy or girl posts really is very thought-provoking, and gave him some applause, or her, as well as starred and flagged the mother. You know, I'm not this big religious theologian like the Johninator. You know, I'm agnostic by choice, but I can see that something that proclaims something happened hundreds of years before, or the story of, you know, 100 years before it actually happening, I could see where that would really rock the cart for a lot of people that are very devout, religious, you know, whatever they are.
Bill, could you hear that music in the background? I think it was Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
You know, I'm out of my element here in religion. I'm sorry, you know. I told a Catholic priest when we were getting the crap blown out of us in Phan Rang, you know, that I hadn't been to Mass in, 10 years. And he says, you really should have a long, whatever the thing is when you go into the thing. Whatever it is.
Hey, this is a fabulous story you're sharing.
You're close to 60. My short-term memory sucks.
Radio short-termer. All right.
But anyway, I told him I put on a series of cassettes. Okay, I know that was a silly sidebar. But still, I mean, you know, those people that really are into the religious thing and whatever, I can see where this would rock their world. You know, and I did read this, believe it or not. It was hard to get through it all because I'm not a big religious reader guy, you know, but no, I can see where this would really shake some people's belief system. I really do.
Oh, definitely. And this is there's a whole, as you know, because we have a conspiracy in religion forum, there's a whole subtext of religious conspiracy that postulates the possibility that the Roman Emperor Constantine, in bringing about this Council of Nicaea, where the whole event was really designed to create the doctrine by which the church can control people.
Right.
And the Jesus story was certainly the primary story around which the church focused everything.
Right.
And this little piece of the puzzle starts to lend credence to that undercurrent of conspiracy related to the Nicene Council.
Right. And, you know, the control factor itself has been prevalent in religion all through the conception of mankind. In fact, at one time, this used to just really bother me as a kid. I remember reading in a theological history book how the church, and this could be many factions of the church, at one time, if you owned a Bible or even had memorized certain scriptures from the Bible, you'd be burned. Just like a witch, yeah. It was basically illegal for you to own the scriptures because it was considered to be so holy that only a holy person should be in contact with the Bible.
Right, and after they decided what books were to be in the New Testament, Constantine set about. I think he had 50 of them copied, you know, by the monks in the towers, transcribing the Bibles, and sent one to each of the 50 churches that were formed as a result.
Yeah, well, congratulations to both of you. But I've got to ask this one question. It's a new question that's posted on the Skeptic Overview question in the information area.
I guess
it's
that means we're through, Bill, with what we were talking about.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, we can do this another time.
All right. How much is the doggy?
$12.
Now, the reason why I said that is because he has a bet going in his office pool on whether I can get his name right without fluffing it up again. And I just now noticed he's got a new avatar. It says, Yum Yum, I Heart Rabbit. And there's this dog eating a rabbit. So I guess it's supposed to be me. Okay, asceticism. Thank you. He gave me a word to practice. Okay, here's the question, and then we'll wrap this thing up. He talks about the new icons that the mods are using to enforce off-topic posts. And he said he would... What's the chance of getting one that says "Don't feed the troll"?
That one, I think there's little chance because that's tends to be very subjective. It'd be fun. It certainly would be fun, but deciding who is a troll and who is not is more of a subjective thing that we're pleased to leave in the hands of our members.
And he just makes one comment, and this is really for Johnny and I, not you, but he says that the ATS Mix is reaching an awesome milestone in podcasting standards, the big 100. Any special plans? How about a video podcast? I'm sure there's someone very talented on ATS who could mix some webcam feeds and edit it together to something very special for the 100th show. So we'll think about that.
Yeah, that could be fun.
Yeah, that could be a lot of fun. So, yeah, we'll do it, you know, at 10 o'clock after everybody's had a few bourbons.
Right. When we're all looking at our absolute best.
Oh, there we go. All right, boss. Another great foray into the mind of the skeptic overlord.
That was just a blast, wasn't it? The bourbon's wearing off. I think I need some more.
Yeah. All right, get medicated.
Yeah, get medicated big time, boss. We'll see you next week.
All right, kids.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye, Bill.
ATS Mix featured interview.
Well, John, I'm really excited because we have the opportunity to have back with us a good friend of ours, I hope, by now, in Cullum Kelleher, and he is going to grace us with more of his expertise and knowledge about not only the Hunt for the Skinwalker and then some of the things from the Brain Trust and his websites, and I'm just really excited, John. Are you?
Yes, I am, and I just want to remind all our members and listeners alike that if you did not get a chance to listen to last week's show, you need to immediately, before listening to any more, you immediately need to go and listen to the first part of our interview with Dr. Kelleher, because you won't really understand what's going on in this part of the interview unless you go and backtrack to last week's show, and that'll bring you up to speed as to what's going on. And by the way, I would like to apologize once again. I'm still doing an investigative report, and I'm on a telephone, and that's why my voice sounds like this.
Well, you sound really good to me, John. So I'm going to get right into introducing or reintroducing to those that have been with us since the first show, our guest today. Cullum Kelleher is a research scientist and author. He received his PhD in biochemistry at Trinity College, Dublin, and has for 21 years of experience in the field of cell and molecular biology. In addition, he was an administrator for a Nevada aerospace company, Space Sciences Incorporated, and was also deputy administrator of the NIDS,
where he led the investigation at Skinwalker Ranch. He currently works in the biotechnology sector. He has published 38 peer-reviewed scientific papers in molecular biology, immunology, biology, biochemistry, and virology, as well as a number of articles in magazines such as Omni and two books, Brain Trust, which was published in 2004, and in 2005 with his co-partner George Knapp, the masterful novel Hunt for the Skinwalker. Please welcome our guest again, Cullum Kelleher. Hi, Cullum. How are you?
Good. Great to be with you guys again, Dave and Johnny.
It's like deja vu all over again.
It is deja vu. In fact, I'm having flashbacks that we're reliving our life all over again. All right. Well, listen, we left off last show and kind of as a cliffhanger, and we really want to get right back into it as quick as we can because there's just so much, and you're doing such a masterful job of giving us intense and very descriptive answers. So let's get right into it, Cullum. There is a mention in the book that an entity was being observed and then shot at. Can you tell us what this creature looked like and what prompted the need to shoot at it?
Well, last week I had mentioned on about a calf that was eviscerated on the property in broad daylight, and this was on March 10th of 2007. Well, it turns out that that raised the threat level on the property. And the ranch manager, who is an expert marksman and also, a hunter, always carried a rifle in his pickup truck. So it was actually two nights after that calf incident that had occurred. And one of the things that we noticed was that all of the domestic animals, that's the dogs and the cats, were staying very, very hidden. They were all either in their kennels or hidden under the command trailer. They were not sort of venturing out the way they usually do. So we knew that something was up, and especially the ranch manager noted this, that there was a sense of threat on the property. So around midnight on, it was March 12th, that was 2 days after the calf incident occurred, the dogs simultaneously outside erupted into barking, and there was obviously a lot of panic going on. So myself and a physicist that was in the command trailer and the ranch manager hopped into his pickup truck, and this was like midnight or so. So we started across the property because the ranch manager was determined not to lose any more cattle because, obviously his job was to protect the cattle on the property.
Right.
Our job was to investigate what was going on the property. So we were in this pickup truck bouncing like at a fairly decent speed across the field, headlights going all over the place. We were we saw the main group of cattle were located on the far end of one field, on the far end of the field that we were going across, but directly in front of the headlights kept bouncing up and down, and two things were obvious. One was that there was what looked like a cow, a very large, animal, standing on its own on the periphery of the field on the opposite end of the pasture from the main group of cattle. So we wondered as we trucked across the field what this cow was doing on its own, because usually in times of stress, they tend to bunch together. At the same time, the headlights picked up this two very large pair of eyes in a tree that were almost directly above this what looked like this cow on the bottom. It was probably about 20 to 30 feet above in the tree, a very large animal. Headlights were kept on bouncing off and reflecting. From the size of the eyes and the distance between the eyes, it was obviously a very large animal. So the ranch manager grimly sort of jammed on the brakes about 40 yards away from the tree line, took his rifle from the back, and without saying anything to anybody, opened the door, got out, and put a bead on the animal in the tree, or what he thought was the animal in the tree, because he was absolutely determined not to let any more of his cattle be eviscerated. So instantly when that happened, he yelled, "I got him." you know, because this guy was a marksman. He could,
right.
he could hit a coyote from 500 yards. So, and this was 30 yards, 40 yards away. So he swore that he got the animal. So we jumped back into the truck and went the remaining 40 yards or so. Now, you know, from the point of view of policy, our policy as scientists and as investigators was certainly not to be shooting at unknown things on the property. The ranch manager was kind of in this sort of 48-hour rage/panic, and that's why it happened. But the long and the short of it was that we went to the tree line. We were expecting to find the carcass of some predator or whatever. There was absolutely nothing on the ground. So here we were trucking around. I had a video camera, a night vision video camera with me, and the physicist, myself, and the ranch manager fanned out on the tree line, and we were looking for what we thought was a wounded animal in the ground. From about 30 yards to my left, the ranch manager started shouting that he saw something. So within seconds, you know, he started shooting again at something. It was like, I think, two or three shots, and the ranch manager, we all rushed to where he was. There was nothing there whatsoever, and the ranch manager described this very, very large, probably a 400-pound animal that looked like it was ready to spring at him, and he said he just had no option but to shoot in self-defense.
Right.
We got there. There was absolutely nothing, so we quartered the ground. And remember, we're still sort of March 12th. We're still on the same unmelted snow as in the trees. So we were tromping around with flashlights, and I had a video camera. We did come across some tracks that we could not explain. They looked like there was a single set of tracks in one part of the snow, and then about 10 feet away, there was another set of tracks. They were completely unlike anything that we'd seen before. It looked more like a large bird or something that had been lying or had made the tracks in the snow. We took photographs and all of that, videotaped the tracks, but we never found either of the two animals, either the large animal that was underneath the tree that we first mistook for a cow that we think may have been that large animal that the ranch manager shot the second time, or the large, he thought it looked like a very large cat in the tree when he was drawing a bead on it. But again, we saw plainly that the two animals as we were approaching, but they vanished into thin air. We immediately called a professional tracker early the next morning. We got the tracker onto the property. He basically quartered the entire place for about half a mile radius, and he found absolutely no tracks whatsoever. Nothing unusual except for those two sets of tracks that we had found the night before.
Wow.
That he couldn't explain, and we couldn't explain. But, you know, that happened within 48 hours of that calf getting eviscerated. And it was really the only time ever that firearms had been used on the property because, you know, obviously when we reported back to the Science Advisory Board on the incident, there was universal condemnation that firearms had been used on the property in that way.
Right.
But, you know, it was a spontaneous act of, you know, somewhere between panic and self-defense on the part of the ranch manager, and he never announced what he was going to do before he did it.
I have a question I obviously want to ask about some more events that happened there at the ranch. I myself, as an amateur ufologist, column, and also a paranormal investigator, have had a chance to go to a number of different areas where I experienced a drop in almost like the power or the energy in some of the equipment and devices I was using. You just mentioned that you had ran up there with a camera. I was curious if at any point in time during your guys' investigation out there, did you guys happen to experience the same type of event where you find a loss of power or a loss of electricity or energy from your batteries being drained in certain parts of at the ranch itself?
That's actually a very good question, and yeah, and the answer to it is yes. I mean, it seemed like every time that we had something in our sights, we started off actually with Canon EOS cameras, which are these single lens reflex. They were all electronic cameras, and that actually happened to us so many different times in the early part of 1997 especially, that we just essentially switched to very, very old cameras that were only manual, that didn't operate by batteries, precisely for that reason. We had so many times when we had something like an object that looked like it was brightly lit in the camera's sights. We tried to take a photograph and the camera battery would die. Same thing with the video camera. On multiple occasions, the video camera camera battery also died. So it was an extremely frustrating experience, especially when we were in the business of trying to report to the scientific advisory board the fact that we had multiple instances of camera batteries dying looked to them like bad planning as opposed to stuff that was happening in the field, because we always obviously had backup batteries. But if you're trying to photograph a transient object with a camera, you've only got maybe a second or 2 seconds to execute. And during that time, if your battery dies, you're basically out of luck. And by the time you replace the battery, things have moved on. So we encountered, in answer to your question, we encountered multiple instances of that, to the extent that we had to go to all manual camera.
Right. And I just wanted to point out to our listeners and to our members alike that until something like this actually happens to you, you can be scratching your head and go, oh, yeah, right. But when it does happen, that in itself, to me, almost leans towards more credibility that there is actually an event happening. Otherwise, it wouldn't be draining the power itself.
Yes. And I should also say that we registered on our magnetic field instruments multiple times when there were dramatic spikes in magnetic activity during these encounters. So, it was not unusual to have a detectable spike in magnetic field at the same time when we were encountering these sudden unexplained losses of battery power.
What are some of the other odd events that have happened there? We've heard about some of the creatures. We heard about the mutilation of a calf. What are some of the other weird creatures and UFOs that were observed there during your time?
Well, one of the other parts that sticks in my mind was this was in June of 1997, and we had another investigator who had been in the particular area. It was a very small pasture that was ringed with trees. So you were kind of almost in a bubble when you were in that pasture, very small, enclosed almost entirely by trees, and about 50 to 100 feet ahead of us, there was an old abandoned building that used to be a homestead back in the 20s or 30s. But previously, an investigator using infrared film in a camera had shot some very unusual lights around this homestead and had recorded them on infrared film. They were spectacular. So myself and this physicist were on the property about a week later to see if we could replicate any evidence of anomalous activity in that area. So we were standing in the middle of the pasture. It was about midnight. And remember, you're out in the middle of nowhere. There may be sort of one distant yard light sort of a couple of miles away, but except for that, it's absolute total darkness. You know, there's absolutely nothing in the area whatsoever. We had another team of a couple of people about a mile away, also on the property, but quite a distance away. And we had two dogs with us. We always had dogs close by us, as they were very, very good biosensors. They could pick up any sort of activity in the area where we couldn't hear anything, we couldn't see anything. But these dogs were very good at warning us if anything was in the area. So we always trekked around this property with dogs. So on this particular night, we were scanning this area of the building where this investigator had photographed this unusual object, when about probably a 100 yards to our left, but still in the same pasture, this light just blinked on. It was about the size of a basketball. It was about 15 feet off the ground. It was like bluish white light. It was hovering there. It looked like it was unsteady. And it appeared out of nowhere. And as you can imagine, in complete darkness, there was, you know, it made a big effect. The two dogs that were with us moved very close to where we were. I mean, they stopped playing around or hunting for raccoons or what they usually would be doing. They moved very close to us, and we were looking at this object, and then suddenly, a few seconds later, it just blinked out. So instantly, we leapt into action. We had with us some of these powerful law enforcement Maxibeam lights that you can light up the whole area for miles around on this, with these things. So instantly, we activated it, flooded the pasture with light, and there was nothing there. There was absolutely nothing there. So we searched the place. We went down to where we had seen the object, which was in the pasture with us. It was not behind the trees or above the trees or anything. It was right in the pasture with us. It was maybe 70 to 100 yards away from us. But long story short, we couldn't find anything. There was nothing there. So we went back to our original position, shut off all our lights. The physicist beside me had a pair of Generation 3 ITT night vision binoculars, so he activated them and was scanning the perimeter with them. And I had my manual camera with infrared film. That, remember, because of the battery power losses, we switched to manual cameras. So I had a manual camera that I was that I had. So probably a couple of minutes later, the physicist sort of exclaimed, you know, as he was scanning the perimeter of the trees with his night vision binoculars, that he saw something in the trees, and he started describing it as a fairly large amorphous black blob. You know, I mean, he was descriptive, but mostly sort of getting concerned because he didn't know what it was. It was blocking out the stars that were easily visible, you know, through the night vision binoculars. It was moving slowly from south to north, right through the trees. It looked like it was actually in the trees, and it was probably, if you took a rough diameter, about 60 to 70 feet in diameter. It was pretty big. Now, remember, it was pitch black. He was the guy with the Generation 3 ITT infrared. I had nothing except an old manual camera with me, and I had other detection equipment. But
I want to ask just a quick question. What nanometer filtering were used on your IR?
It was active up to about 3,000 nanometers.
Okay.
So it could detect anything between the end of the visible range / start of the infrared range all the way up to 3,000 nanometers. So, okay. I mean, it was pretty good. So he started seeing, as the thing moved slowly from south to north, he started really freaking out. And this guy was a physicist, had worked with NASA for a long time. I mean, this guy was not prone to freaking out. So he started freaking out that there was some sort of interaction between him and whatever object was in the trees. And remember, I couldn't see anything. I was standing 15 feet to my left. We had two dogs who were now jammed up behind us. They were jammed against the backs of our legs. I mean, they were obviously intimidated, and they too were focused, you know, on that same spot on the trees that this guy was describing. So he started saying that there was something had grabbed hold of his mind, and he was talking about telepathic communication. And here I was with the manual camera, you know, taking long exposure infrared shots in that direction, hoping I might pick something up in the infrared with the infrared film. But, you know, he started freaking out and sort of saying that he was getting these telepathic communications from something saying, "We are watching you," in a sort of a threatening way. This went on for like a few minutes, and then he started describing this black object as collapsing in on itself, and within, you know, another couple of minutes, it had pretty well disappeared. Again, we activated the Maxibeam system, the bright, extremely bright lights, went over to the spot where all of this had happened, and, you know, essentially found nothing. The dogs, after a couple of minutes, they started moving away from us in a sign that they were beginning to relax, and they started playing around as if nothing had happened. this guy, this physicist, was very, very shaken by this whole thing. He felt like he had something had invaded his mind, and for a few seconds he said he couldn't do anything, he couldn't think, he couldn't do anything. And this was the guy, this incident had actually provoked nightmares and, you know, in this guy for several months afterwards. It was the only time that something like that had happened, but it was a very good indicator that there was events happening around us that if we didn't have the availability of night vision and being able to see into the infrared. And remember, a week previously, this other guy had picked up phenomena also in the infrared region with infrared film. So around this particular object, within a two-week period, there was a lot of activity that was happening that was detectable in the infrared region of the spectrum but not detectable in the visible range. In other words, I could not see anything that was going on while this whole, very intense incident was unfolding.
Well, John, in the essence of time, because we want to be able sure that we get to as many member questions as we can and also to some special questions by Barb Campbell, I'm going to go to this last one. Colin, this question is probably just begging to be asked. You know, I'm sure you guys have just, you know, tons of video and photographs and other data that you've gathered. What happened to them, and will Johnny and I and the rest of the public ever be privy to them?
Right now, all of the videotape evidence, all of the photographs, all of the magnetic field traces and all of the equipment data is at the National Institute for Discovery Science. Now, as I mentioned, in October of 2004, I left the National Institute for Discovery Science and moved on to another career, essentially. So the short answer to your question is that it is the property of NIDS, and it will be, dispensed or not, according to the wishes of the CEO of NIDS. I personally don't have any say in determining whether or not it will ever be released to the public. But, you know, the long and the short of it, there is a lot of data that's there, but in terms of being unequivocal, unambiguous evidence for, you know, name your topic, non-human intelligence or paranormal phenomena or whatever, there are things that are captured, this is not a smoking gun.
Right.
We never captured the data that we would call a smoking gun.
Well, are you ready to perhaps answer some questions from our members here from AboveTopSecret.com?
Certainly, yes.
We have a new feature here at AboveTopSecret.com, which actually allows people that are not members of our fine website, which, by the way, we'd like to ask, why not? Why don't you join? It's free. To be able to post anonymously. And this first question is from one of our anonymous guests that came by. And the question is this. Setting aside the science, in your gut, Doctor, what do you think is really going on at the Skywalker Ranch? I don't mean what you can prove or what your experiments say, but what does your instinct and gut tell you?
Yeah, that's a very hard one because, we spent 2 to 3 years doing exactly the opposite of, you know, gut instinct and intuition and all of that, trying to gather data. But I think the bottom line of what I took away from the Skinwalker Ranch was that there was a series of there was something intelligent interacting with NID staff up there, especially during that frenetic summer and spring of 1997, when every time we were up there, we were barraged by, you know, these balls of light and these objects that seemed like they were playing a cat and mouse game. So it was always like we were reaching and trying to capture all of these objects on film and what have we. But there did seem to be an interaction with some kind of an intelligence. So I suppose my gut feeling is that we encountered something that is not readily explainable by standard scientific, you know, it's not in the physics textbooks. But In terms of what it is, who the hell knows? I mean, I have no idea.
I have no
idea of what it is, but I do know that it was operating as if it did not want to be photographed, etc. And there was enough times when it interacted with us closely that we knew that something was going on, that, you know, that something unexplained was going on.
Right. Okay, I'm going to go next to John. I'm going to skip one. I'm going to go next to Timber. Okay. And his question is pretty interesting. It says, Dr. Kelleher, during your time at NIDS, you are quoted as saying, "We don't study aliens, we study anomalies. They're the same thing in a lot of people's minds, but not in our minds." And he wants to know if you could elaborate on exactly what you meant by that statement.
Well, One of the things that really drove the formation of the National Institute for Discovery Science was the whole philosophy that the way gigantic leaps in science are made is by studying anomalies, and that anomalies really provide a window into the discovery process in science. Hence the name National Institute for Discovery Science. So there was a definite focus on studying anomalies on the fringe of science with the hope that we would learn a lot of information quickly. So this was like a high risk, high, you know, high payoff or sort of procedure. So our entire institute was based on that idea that science will move forward either by incremental steps, or it could move forward in leaps and bounds. And the way it would move forward in leaps and bounds would be by focusing on anomalies. And, I mean, there's a long history in the history of science that shows that, you know, studying quote-unquote anomalies actually does provide a springboard to big leaps. And, you know, that there's the whole entry into quantum physics, for example, at the end of the 19th, start of the 20th century, you could say was just initiated by studying something that seemed like initially quirky. I mean, physics had everything apparently explained at the end of the 19th century, and it was only by studying aspects of anomalies that quantum physics really came into being. So we had that same philosophy that anything that was anomalous, you know, I mean, that could be cattle mutilations. I mean, cattle mutilations were very amenable to study because there was a dead body on the ground.
Right.
And we could apply standard forensic science to investigating. But they were still anomalies. Who was perpetrating these cattle mutilations? Why were they, you know, killing these animals? Why were they taking these organs from these animals? So they were anomalies. So we made the distinction that the study of anomalies in science is the way to go. The whole question of alien versus extraterrestrial versus, you know, different levels of consciousness or different dimensions. I mean, there was a whole bunch of theories out there on how to explain some of these phenomena and also plain paranormal explanations. We didn't want to get caught in a particular web. You know, for example, we did not want to be jumping into a quote-unquote extraterrestrial explanation for the events on the Utah Ranch. We wanted to focus on getting the data, essentially.
Sure. And I would just like to point out that our members here also are pretty astute, and they're going to be jumping around here in their questions, Doctor, because some of them will be dealing with the Skinwalker Ranch, and some of them will actually be dealing with what you received your PhD in biochemistry with. So that's kind of nice, and I applaud our members for that. One of them is Waking Up. Member Waking Up wants to know, say, Doctor, what are your thoughts on this thing called Morgellons or Morgellons? Do you have any thoughts on the Morgellons theory?
That is one topic I have not spent much time on. I really haven't gone into it, so no, I can't really comment on Morgellons. I haven't gone into which particular infectious organism it is or what the evidence is. I really haven't gone into it. Sorry.
Fair enough.
Okay, then in that case, I'm gonna fast forward a little bit, John. This is going to be from your friend Mark, a.k.a. Springer, one of our bosses and one of the owners of AboveTopSecret.com. And Mark's question is this. I would like to get your opinion on the cattle mutilation situation. There are two theories that are prominent. One is certainly possible, and the other has no supporting evidence whatsoever, yet seems to get all the press. And he goes on to say the two theories are, number one, aliens are mutilating our livestock for DNA samples and other biological specimens. Or number two, the U.S. military accidentally allowed an experimental bioweapon to get into the food chain that has caused everything from CJD to Alzheimer's disease, and the government covered it up for obvious reasons. The mutilations are performed by government-funded scientists who are covertly monitoring the livestock in the hope of tracking the spread or decline of this bioweapon via these mutilations. So now we get to his question. Do you think there is a disinformation campaign column being waged to keep the loony factor, in other words, the aliens are doing it, associated with these mutilations so very few, if any, credible researchers will ever take a look at this?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And you know, when we were at NIDS, one of our main focuses was the cattle mutilation phenomenon. So we investigated probably 50 plus cases in different states around the country, you know, California, Utah, Montana, Nevada, all around mostly the west part of the United States. So I think Mark's question is a good one, because one of the things that we did was to try to get a fix on this was we paid a visit to Colorado State University Veterinary Department, which is kind of in the middle of the northeastern part of Colorado, which had in the 70s, 80s, and 90s a complete epidemic of cattle mutilation activity. Hundreds and hundreds of cattle were mutilated in that area. So the CSU in Fort Collins had a pretty good veterinary department. So we went and we, as you know, NID scientists, we sat down with these people for about a day around a table, and we brainstormed about what was going on. And the long and the short answer was that cattle mutilations don't exist. They're essentially just predator activity, and that, you know, there was a lot of snickering around the table about the fact that, you know, little green men were coming down into the area around Sterling, Colorado, and mutilating cattle. So the whole thing was kind of a joke in the minds of the CSU professors. And that brings to mind, you know, the essence of Mark's question is it is a very convenient thing that if there is, and I certainly believe there is a genuine phenomenon of cattle mutilations, that it is automatically tarred with that brush of, you know, ridicule and trivialization, that it's an automatic trigger for blocking serious scientific study. And I think you can say the same thing for the UFO phenomenon in general, that one of the ways of keeping serious scrutiny away from the UFO phenomenon is to, you know, make sure all of the loony bin stories are highlighted and publicized so that, you know, the whole area becomes a laughing stock. So cattle mutilations definitely fit the bill there. And there was a famous study in the late 1970s on cattle mutilations, orchestrated by an ex-FBI agent called Ken Rommel. And he was actually paid by the state of New Mexico to undertake the study, because there was near hysteria in northern New Mexico on the number of cattle mutilations that had happened in the previous few years. And the end result of the Rommel report was that, you know, this was a fictitious phenomenon sort of orchestrated by ignorant farmers and ranchers who had no idea what they were talking about, and, you know, they were sort of talking about space aliens. There was a general aura of ridicule. So with respect to the infectious disease part of Mark's question, I certainly believe that there's a lot of a very suspicious coincidence in terms of both the geography of the of the eruption of cattle mutilation cases and the overlapping large-scale prion disease locations, both in Colorado and also there's a very specific area in northwestern Saskatchewan where there's a three separate outbreaks of prion disease have occurred in cattle, in sheep, and in deer that overlap almost precisely with a rash of cattle mutilation activity in northwestern Saskatchewan in Canada. So, you know, if you join the dots in both northwestern Saskatchewan, Colorado, and other places, and you track back through history, you can actually see there's a lot of correlation and suggestion that at least part of the cattle mutilation phenomenon is a wildlife, it's the equivalent of a wildlife sampling exercise, the tracking of an infectious agent in the nation's cattle. And the reason it's secret is because there's an enormous amount of financial loss involved. If the mad cow disease or infectious abnormally folded protein thing ever gets off in the United States, I mean, you can see, for example, even recently, South Korea, there's rioting in the streets. I just read a report today on CNN that there's actually rioting in the streets in South Korea because the South Korean government have finally agreed to let United States beef back into South Korea after South Korea blocked importation of beef into South Korea following the 2003 mad cow case in the United States. That cost the American economy $4 billion, and money talks. So there's a lot of indirect evidence from many, many different areas to suggest that at least some of the cattle mutilations are consistent with infectious disease monitoring. However, there are a small subset, and some of that subset needs investigated. I mentioned last week the mutilation and dismemberment of a calf on the property of the Skinwalker Ranch in 1997. I don't believe that was anything to do with wildlife infectious disease monitoring. I believe it was a case of there was something else involved. We also investigated two other cases that were very similar to that calf mutilation. One, a couple of cases in California, and they fit that tiny minority of cases that are not consistent with infectious disease monitoring. So I think, you know, Mark may well be right. There's a small number of cases that are very difficult to explain, but the large amount of cases that are infectious disease monitoring are used as a cover because nobody will investigate a case of cattle mutilations if it's tarred with the idea of little green men coming down from the skies and butchering our cows.
Pellet poison, and I'm going to pretty much paraphrase what this member's question is. If CJD, which of course I believe that doesn't that stand for Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
Yes, it does.
Okay. If CJD can incubate for up to 50 years, does that mean that all us beef eaters in the UK, Canada, and USA are doomed to a horrible death in the upcoming years?
Well, we've already seen the sort of the front end of an epidemic that's happened in the United Kingdom and in Europe beginning in the late 90s and spreading into 2005, 2006. Hundreds of people, over 150 people and counting, have now come down and died. Mostly young people have died from eating contaminated mad cow infected beef. So the question is, are we at the front end of an epidemic or are we at the end of an epidemic? And obviously the people in the Department of Health in the various Western governments are trying to placate the public and saying, you know, it's all over, we have nothing to worry about. But, you know, the latest scientific data is showing that there are two sets of groups of people with different genetic susceptibilities to CJD in the Western world, and the first group are consistent with a faster unveiling of mad cow disease, and the second group are more consistent with a slower unveiling. And remember, most of the studies on these diseases in humans have been conducted on a remote tribe in Papua New Guinea of cannibals that propagated the disease by eating their dead cousins. And so it's been shown that this disease can incubate in this in these tribes people who are still, by the way, dying of mad cow or prion disease 40 years after, you know, they last ate their last dead family member. This tribe was cannibals up till the Australian government outlawed cannibalism all the way back in the 70s. But there are still tribes people that are dying of this disease decades later. So we know that it's an extremely long incubation period. So I suppose the short answer to your member's question is that we don't know. We don't know whether we're at the front end of this epidemic or if, you know, we're further into it, because only time will tell.
Colm has answered pretty much a lot of these, but I'm going to ask one more, John, and then I'm going to let you ask your friend's question. I'm going to go to Seen Too Much. Now, this is kind of a really interesting question, Colm. Are you bound by any non-disclosure agreement that is related in any form or fashion to Bigelow or the United States government? And if so, how restrictive are these non-disclosure agreements that you had to consent to?
I am bound by a non-disclosure agreement with the National Institute for Discovery Science. In other words, I signed a non-disclosure agreement. Anything that has been published since that time or talked about since that time was previously talked about publicly during the tenure of the National Institute for Discovery Science. There are things that I cannot talk about, is the bottom line. I don't have any non-disclosure agreements with any arm or branch of the United States government, but I do have one with the NIDS.
All right, we have a friend of BuffTopSecret.com by the name of Barb Campbell, and she is located in Canada, and I believe it's actually in part of the Saskatchewan area of Canada. And she is a researcher investigator in cattle mutilations. And she had a number of questions here, but because of time constraints, I'm not going to be able to ask all of them. But I know there is one in particular that she would be truly sore if I did not ask this question, because you're probably one of the few people my asking this that might even have an answer for her. And this would be this. She says, I would assume that NIDS has examined hair samples in many of these cattle mutilations. She wants to know, and I apologize, I am not even going to be able to come close in pronouncing this chemical structure, but it is, was 3-hydroxynucleic acid found on any of the hair samples that they examined? Not in hair, suggesting in the bloodstream, but actually on the hair. 3-HAA can be a degradation product of tryptophan. However, I am referring to the substance actually of 3-HAA. I'm aware of a heifer mutilated in Utah some years ago who was found to have tryptophan in her system. It was believed that she had been sedated prior to her death. Have you any word on this?
I can answer directly the case she was talking about, because we investigated it. And very quickly, this was a cow that was mutilated in northeastern Utah. It was about 30 miles from the ranch. But it was a perfect incision around the eye of the animal. The eye had been removed, and there was a bluish gel found on that area of the eye that we subjected to a whole bunch of chemical analysis. And to cut a long story short, we found two things that were suspicious. Number one, we found significant levels of formaldehyde in that, which is used as a preservative. But the second thing we found was a component called oxandole, which is a sedative. Used at high levels as a sedative. In lower levels, it's actually a byproduct of normal human normal animal metabolism. So it's a very clever way of disguising. If you're using a sedative, the last thing you want is to leave telltale fingerprints, so to speak, of a sedative in the system. So what you would use is something that could be mistaken as a normal breakdown product of metabolism. So that's exactly what this was. The 3-HAA is, I believe it's 3-hydroxyantranilic acid. Is that what you're...
I believe that's what she's leaning towards.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so we have never found that particular substance in any of the mutilations that we've investigated, but we have found, as I said, oxandole, which is actually, it's a relative of tryptophan also. And also we found another substance called succinate, which is a high levels of succinate, which is a derivative of a sedative called succinylcholine, which is used to anesthetize animals. So, you know, there are two pretty strong evidence in our book that there was sedatives used on some of these animals. There was another case that we came across in Montana where the mutilated cow was rolled over and was this big, extremely large gauge hypodermic needle lying under the animal. So that's not like indicative of, you know, aliens coming down to...
Right. Right.
To mutilate the animal. This was an ordinary piece of hardware that's used all around the world to make sure that the flow of blood from a particular artery is maximized, very large gauge needle. So if you combine the evidence from the sedatives that we found through chemical analysis and some of these other, you know, the hardware and a whole bunch of other things, that's, I think, consistent with... you know, non-terrestrial intervention.
Okay. All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for being with us on the second show. I know you have a life besides doing interviews, and I can assure you that not only Johnny and I, but the owners of AboveTopSecret.com and all the members and the guests that comprise the 23 million fan base that we have worldwide are definitely going to enjoy not only this show, but if they haven't had a chance to listen to your first show, to be sure and do that.
I just want to interject. Please, folks, you can get more information by going to Colm's website, which is at www.colmkelleher.com. That's colmkelleher.com. The book is entitled Brain Trust. Read it. It might save your life. And also, we want to remind everybody that the majority of the information that we've been discussing about the hunt for the skinwalker is available at Amazon.com. In fact, prior to this, I went and I couldn't find it at Barnes & Noble, and I went down to Borders, and I bought myself a copy so that I could scan through it for this interview here. It will blow you away, the information that is in this book that he wrote with George Knapp. Truly, you have enhanced my life during these past two interviews, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much. That's high praise indeed. I very much enjoyed both interviews. I think you guys are doing one hell of a job.
John was remiss in giving the website for the Hunt for the Skinwalker, but I want to give it to you. It's www.huntfortheskinwalker.com. And again, Colm, if you would please hang on, we want to say our goodbyes to you off air. So, and I hope we'll be able to get you back on, you know, somewhere down the way, because we literally, and Johnny can attest to this, we literally had probably another good 1 to 2 shows of questions.
Okay, that sounds good.
Well, Dave, another fantastic show that you and I had little to do with.
That's right. It's like getting on the runaway train, John.
Yes.
You hold on for dear life and hope that it slows down. But it
and
never
we want
does.
To especially thank all our fine friends that stopped by and participated in this show. And want to remind everybody that coming up very soon, you are going to hear Dr. Michio Kaku. And we have a question thread posted up in the ATS Mix Arena, and suggest, if you haven't had a chance, to go there and ask your question to the foremost theorist on string theory and physics.
I have one question. How did you figure out how to pronounce his last name?
I've heard other interviews with him.
Oh, okay.
So I'm just going by what other people said.
Well, Magic Mystery Tour kind of came to mind when we were when I was trying to figure out how to pronounce it, you know.
Are you talking about the Beatles?
Cuckoo, cuckoo.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.